Welcome to Call Jeshurun, a podcast from Temple B'nai Jeshurun, a vibrant and flourishing Reformed Jewish community in Short Hills, New Jersey. Welcome. I am Rabbi Matthew Gewirtz. Call Jeshurun is where you can come to engage with teachings of relevant wisdom and music. You will hear from our clergy, staff, and guest speakers who will help bring meaning into a world that so badly needs it. If you would like to learn more about our congregation, please visit us at tbj.org.
This is the Rabbi in Rebbetzin, take two.
Take two.
So hi, everybody. It's Rabbi Karen.
And Lauren Rutkin.
And we know that lots of you couldn't be at the conversation we had last week about Nobody Wants This, the Netflix show. And for reasons we explained there, we didn't want to record our conversation. We wanted people to feel like they could be private, they could ask questions, but we really wanted to continue the conversation, and we knew that many of you asked us to record something. So here we are.
Here we are.
And it's been a few days since that conversation, and Lauren, what did you think of the conversation, and what are you thinking about now?
I love the conversation. I think people really enjoyed it. People opened up about some of the topics. And as we have heard that season two is coming, we have been asked to even come back for season two, which is exciting. We did start the conversation about the arrival of the show and the context and why we kind of felt like maybe it exploded the way it has. I mean, for me, I think for some of us, it's been a really tough year. And the show for me was a little bit lighter than some of the things I tend to watch, read, or see. I know it touched on some difficult topics, but for me, I thought it was a nice break from somewhat of my reality, although some things did parallel my life.
Well, and it reminded us that, I mean, in the world of Nobody Wants This, there doesn't seem to be any anti-Semitism. Israel does not exist. There's no sort of contemporary Jewish life. There's no like rally or big thing that the rabbi's having to do. And so it did sort of allow us to kind of remember that there's a world, you know, as much as it's hard to remember, there is a Jewish world that exists separate from that. And there are lots of things about being Jewish. It's interesting to think about in the show, if he had said, you know, I want to tell you all about Judaism, you know, let's go to, you know, I mean, they're in LA, but let's go to the, you know, Wiesenthal Center and learn about the Holocaust. I mean, that would have been a really different take than let's go outside and, you know, let's do Havdalah. So it is interesting that they sort of don't have that happening. You know, there was, I think it was Sex and the City that was really criticized for sort of never acknowledging that 9/11 happened. And they, in fact, there was a scene where they edited out the Twin Towers because it was shot, I think, before September 11th. And so how TV shows deal with that is sort of something similar.
So I guess we'll see for season two if they raise it.
I guess. But we got into this a little bit, but I do think we wanted to sort of continue talking about the stereotypes of the people, because I think that in some ways every single, it wasn't just the mother, the sister-in-law, everybody was sort of a stereotype, even the father, right? I mean, the idea of these sort of everyone's pushy, or they're being pushed around, or, you know, sort of even what their home looked like. What did you think about the characters, all of the characters, and the way that they represented their religion, their sex, their culture, whatever?
It was stereotypical. The Jewish women were dark hair, dark eyes. They all kind of had the same look in some ways. Joanne and her sister were obviously blonde. That was clearly done on purpose, which these are stereotypes. You know, I heard an interview where they were talking about hot rabbi, and he said, I'm hot brother, I'm hot son, I'm a hot professional, I'm not just a hot rabbi. And when we think about rabbis, what they should look like, there's so much more to a rabbi than what you look like. But we do kind of think of the old school male beard, and we're so fortunate in our own congregation that we have a lot of different makeups of what makes a clergy person, and that our children can look in the mirror and see themselves in that image, which I think is important. But there were stereotypes, for sure, and it is controversial.
And there was one woman rabbi. I mean, there was another. We only met a second rabbi, and we only met her for a moment. But you know, there were even some conversations amongst my colleagues that, you know, she kind of had this camp counselor vibe. You know, she was sort of unremarkable. Like, I am not even sure I can tell you what she looked like, but she wasn't especially, you know, she wasn't dressed in a way that was flashy. She wasn't meant to be sort of beautiful or anything, because she's, you know, sort of next to this, you know, to his girlfriend. And so in some ways, he's supposed to be hot rabbi and she's kind of, you know, unremarkable. I mean, honestly, like totally neutral, like yeah. not super attractive, not unattractive. And, you know, I think the idea that, you know, and of course everyone is, you know, kind of thin or there's sort of like everyone sort of is an ordinary thing where, you know, it's like not super realistic to what, like, and of course the way that I think a lot of shows are shot now is that ethnically they're sort of like in that dinner party, there's one black person, one Asian person, one, and you know, feel like a little bit like it's typecast. But yeah, the sister-in-law, they all have that like dark straight hair and almost like a Sephardic look. I mean, I feel like they were almost cast to look this way to be this really stark contrast from Joanne and her sister, who are blonde and kind of supposed to be like even sexy, or the idea that when they come into the bat mitzvah, they're, you know, there and it's very flashy. That's really supposed to be different than the Jewish relatives and even the Jewish wives and girlfriends of the basketball players. Like when she shows up at the basketball game, she is supposed to be super different from them and sort of the opposite, and especially the opposite of the, what's her name, Rebecca? The ex-fiance.
When I started dating Matthew, people who have known me a long time said, "You're dating a rabbi?" It didn't connect. It didn't make sense to them, because people, again, have a picture of what a rabbi should look like. And I always laugh because a few weeks ago, a friend came up to me and said, "What do you think of the show?" And, you know, just for the record, you know, non-Jewish women are not the only people dancing on tables, metaphorically, at a party. And I laugh because a few dates in, Matthew came to meet all my friends and we were literally dancing on the tables. So the stereotype of, you know, just the non-Jewish women having fun is actually not accurate. But there is a lot written on the stereotypes. Are they dangerous in this moment? I would say some of it was cringy. For sure.
What was like the cringiest moment?
You know, the controlling aspect of the Jewish women felt cringy to me. You know, all of them were very strong personalities. I'm very proud of my strong personality. I don't see it as a negative. And of course, the mother, Noah's mother, very obviously a strong character in this. And, you know, they didn't get into her immigrant story, which we could talk about for season two, maybe. You know, why does she act this way? Why does she feel concerned about the Jewish community? Why does she want her son to marry within the Jewish community? All of those things are important, but I could understand how people might be, critical of the stereotypes. I understand that, but I also feel like there were a lot of beautiful things about the show that maybe balanced my feelings around it. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I wish, you know, I think that there's sort of, there's strong personalities, but it didn't seem like her strong personality had any, like, it's not like she was super into, she was like a social justice warrior. She was like, you know, it seemed like she was controlling to be controlling. Like there wasn't, we didn't see what the controlling personality did that was actually positive. Because one of the things about, I also have a strong personality and I have, you know, is to use that power for good, to use your strong voice to stand up for what you think is right. And, you know, if she had, you know, been, I don't know, marching for Soviet Jewry, or if we had even gotten a little bit of that, I think it would have made her less harsh, because all we see is that she is, like, mean. Essentially, she is sort of not just, she doesn't just want her son to marry someone Jewish. It's almost like she doesn't want him to marry this. Like, she seemed even fearful of Joanne's presence. And, you know,
she's everything that she is not, maybe, and what she doesn't understand. And it could represent the loss of her son from herself, from the community.
Or maybe what she felt like she couldn't have. You know, I think for a lot of immigrants...
Which goes to the charcuterie board.
Right, exactly. Like, she was never allowed to eat, you know, to eat that, but she also had to keep it together because, you know, there is this generation of I think, Jews, but Jewish women who, you know, really thought that if they took their eye off their child's future spouse, that was the end of the Jewish people. I mean, there is sort of this fear that we have that... And I think people have it today of, you know, if your child ends up married to someone who's not Jewish, you can lose them, but also the community loses them. You know, it's not
to fear.
And I think we see that, you know, I think the Jewish community, especially in the last year, has really had to look itself in the mirror and say, you know, what are we doing with our kids? You know, how are we investing in them? And it's not just enough to, you know, Birthright Israel did a lot of good, but I think part of it was people thought, well, I'll go on Birthright Israel and that's enough. You know, bar mitzvah and birthright, and, you know, and for some people they, you know, met their person on birthright and have sailed off into the sunset, but it doesn't always work that way. And I think that, you know, I'm a relatively new parent, and so I'm far from this stage of life, but, you know, I even see the ways that I'm like, oh, well, of course, XYZ, you know, who your child ends up as. And I did have compassion for her because she, I think, thought she was doing the right thing. Like, marry the right person. It's like the bat mitzvah theme. It's almost like the same controlling part of her being like, no, no, you need to have this bat mitzvah theme because that's the right way to do it. And either you didn't, she's trying to make up for something, or she just truly thinks she's right, or she's a little bit mean controlling. Both things can be true at the same time.
Both things can be true, and we'll see what happens in season two. I do hope they go a little deeper into her character and they tone down on some of the stereotypes. But ultimately, I didn't really, and we'll talk about anti-Semitism later, but I didn't really see it as anti-Semitic, which I know is a big topic.
Well, I actually, the only thing I thought was, it wasn't anti-Semitic, but I did not like, is that I thought it was really strange that the show was released basically the week of the High Holy Days. Like, I think that there's something about a show, I mean, it would sort of be a show about a priest on, you know, it felt sort of like the timing was weird. But as I've read more...
Although maybe it was right.
I mean, that's true. But I've actually also read that, you know, the rabbi who consulted on the show, you know, wasn't the final decider. You know, the show's writers and producers and
it's Hollywood.
So, yeah. You know, they have to up the ante. Liz told me this thing once, is that in sitcoms, the big things are small and the small things are big, which is why, like, you know, like the little tiny thing has to be really big because it has to be the show. It has to have a plot. You have to have drama and not just, you can't just have one plot point. You have to have all these plot points. And so we talked about how neither of us really liked the kind of subplot of the siblings and whatever kind of like weird things going on.
Yeah, that was a strange dynamic.
But they also probably like needed something else because, you know, how are they going to like keep the siblings relevant when their siblings were falling for each other? They had to like create a new story.
Subplot. No, that makes sense. And actually going back to stereotypes, I'm sure you and Liz maybe get in your life, wait a minute, you're a rabbi and you're a comedian? I mean, that is not traditional. Those are not traditional professions.
Yes, they are not traditional professions. But, and they also have a lot in common. I mean, they actually have more in common than people think. And because comedy is writing. I mean, it's writing, it's speaking, it's performing. And that's also a lot of what I do. And, you know, I think there were moments on the show that I frankly had to roll my eyes because I think that a woman rabbi in the same situation would be judged more harshly, or would be, you know, the I think there were some places where I like really felt, you know, I think there's like a privilege of being like a hot, single, 30 something rabbi, for him to kind of be able to break his engagement and you know, spend, there's that scene where he's like, oh, we've been in bed for 6 days. And I think that, frankly, you know, being a 35-year-old woman, one does not have that same kind of just ability. I mean, you can, but, you know, you have a biological clock that might be ticking. I think people are tougher. So there were some moments where I was like, hey, you know, I think there was a part of me that felt a little bit like this would have been such a different show if it was about a woman. And I wonder if there were just some things that, like, he was able to be, you know, for him to be able to be kind of out in the world and sexy and all these different things, and also, you know, kind of like loving, and also, you know, able to kind of meet her where she's at. I just don't know that the story would have worked the same way, which is okay. I mean, the story's about
him. Actually, if she was the rabbi, people would have been so concerned about the traditional, the child is only Jewish by a female, mm-hmm. which I know has changed in the Reform movement.
Yes.
Right? Which Rabbi Karen will talk about, but I do think it would have been different. I think the way people are talking about hot rabbi, I don't know if it would have landed the same as hot female rabbi. It just, people wouldn't be as talking about it as loosely, I think.
Well, I think, you know what, at camp, when there's like all the teenage girls, if you had flipped it all and it was a guy, like a man who was at camp with his girlfriend who's the rabbi, and it was all these guys talking about the hot rabbi, I think that A, it just feels like we're not exactly like that era has passed, and that, you know, there is this, you know, I always joke to people, you know, there's sort of this fine line of being, I think, a woman anything, but I can only speak for being a woman rabbi, of being, you know, attractive, approachable, interesting, smart, funny, you know, all these things, and being, you know, wanting people to not be, you know, like I think the hot rabbi being a man is one thing and the hot woman being a rabbi is a different thing, meaning like you want to be sort of not hot on the bima. You know, I want to be sort of like, I don't want to exactly be, you know.
You don't want that to be what people first say about you.
Exactly.
Right. That makes sense. And it kind of goes to what we talked about next is rabbi is real people.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So hot rabbi, you know, what is he like as a real person? And that public-private part of the show, you know, we see the scene where he's in the shop and the, you know, Rabbi Karen and I can talk a lot about the private and the personal, and some of it really resonated with me and some of it was like, well, does that really happen? I don't know. But there definitely is a big part of our life that is very public. And when I met Matthew, I really didn't know what to expect. I grew up, I didn't grow up in a very Jewish household, however someone might want to define that. I found my Judaism much later. After I graduated college, I went to Israel, and I really found this entire new part of me and my life, and I had an adult bat mitzvah, and I worked in the Jewish community. I still work in the Jewish community. So it was a very, my own journey, but I didn't understand fully the whole public nature of this life, and I said when we met in person that one of the reasons why we chose to live in Maplewood 18 years ago was because Matthew chose this career, I chose him and this life, but doesn't mean our kids need to be in this life all the time. And we love Millburn, it's so close to us, you know, the synagogue is obviously in Millburn Short Hills, but we really wanted our kids to have a little bit of a separation where they didn't feel like they were always around our choice. And I don't know if you made similar decisions when you chose where you're living.
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of it for me, I should say, because it was my decision at first, which is that, you know, there is the you part. There's like, you know, where your job is. And I think for me, sometimes I try and differentiate between my job and my work. So my work is being a rabbi and I can't turn that off. That never goes away. My job is being a rabbi here at TBJ. And so, but I have to remember that, when people see me out in the world, it's like, you know, there's not like a, I don't have a different persona. I just,
people are always. But someone runs into you at Starbucks.
Yeah.
You're you.
I'm me. Which means that even if I'm having a really bad day and I, you know, have the impulse that all of us have to be kind of like not great people in the world, you know, I am very aware that, I want to be my best version of myself, but I always joke that, you know, my name might be Karen, but I could never act like a quote unquote Karen in the world. Like if they make my drink wrong, you know, I might say, hi, you know, I'm so sorry you made my drink wrong. But if I couldn't, you know, I can't, you know, yell at a barista. Not that I would really want to, but the idea that I'm always both everywhere I am. And now I also am a parent, and I feel like I have an opportunity to, you know, be a role model for my child and to model that. But you're right. I mean, I think one of the benefits of living where we live, there are other people who, you know, if you live in a smaller town where you sort of have to live in the community, I think that puts other pressures on you. We live in West Orange. I love living close enough that I can always run home. I can, you know, it's easy for me to be in the community. And also, you know, I really feel like when I go home, I could run into people. I mean, I'll share, I lived in an apartment building in South Orange for 5 years. And people would joke that it's where people would live when, so I was also newly divorced, and that was sort of where people lived when they first got divorced. Like they were gonna move out of the house and they could go and live there. And during that time, and there were many, many congregants who lived in that building. And, you know, that was difficult because, you know, sometimes I'd be walking downstairs to get my takeout or, you know, going to the gym, and I would have to see people in a different way. And I really enjoy having a little bit of separation. At the same time, you know, I'm actually meeting two rabbi colleagues in a couple weeks for coffee just to catch up. And the place we want to meet, we all know that we're going to run into our people, but we sort of are going into it with eyes open. If I wanted to, you know, I felt really strongly that I think the like sex shop scene was really, I thought it was sort of odd. I thought it actually was sort of done just for the like sensationalism of it. I think that if you want to do something, not that I think there's anything wrong with them being there, I just wonder if he was sort of doing that to rebel. Like he had just gotten out of this engagement and he's like, there are no rules. I can be different. And I wonder, I don't know. I thought the scene was not as realistic as it could have been. Like, I think he could have been somewhere else. And, you know, what if he had run into, you know,
a teenager
or a congregant with a teen. I mean, what if he had run into something? I mean, there's an ethical part. There were actually clergy I spoke to who said that they thought that whole scene with the congregant and then the making the donation just like bordered on like ethically really weird.
The donation and the bribing, I didn't like that aspect of it. I agree with that. But you brought up a really interesting point with running into people, and I think the challenge is in our personal lives, because we have these multiple personalities. I mean, we have many sides of our personalities, but we're one person. You know, I'm a rabbi's wife, I'm a professional, I'm a mom, I'm a sister. But many of our happiest moments and our saddest moments that we experience personally are also public. And it's not that you didn't want to see people, I'm assuming. Of course, you love our community.
Of course.
But if you're just divorced and you're running into someone all the time, everyone's asking you, how are you? Which is comes from such a beautiful place.
Yeah.
But like, you need a break from talking about it, I'm assuming. So it all comes from a good place, but it just, it's just one of those things that's challenging and beautiful at the same time.
And I think that rabbis, I mean, Rabbi Matt and I are unique in one way, which is that, you know, we have both worked here a really long time, and we have experienced essentially the entire cycle of life publicly. So, you know, your kids' B'nai Mitzvah and, you know, the deaths of your parents, my father-in-law, we lost a baby, I got married, you know, all these sorts of things that we did, and we had to, you know,
navigate
how we wanted to. I mean, I remember, I thought, you know, it's a funny thing to think about, but, you know, I thought about, you know, composing letters for donations that people have made. So thoughtful. People contributed, you know, in the happiest moments and in the saddest moments. And, you know, trying to put into words that, you know, people really love us. I mean, it is, I think, unusual to be so loved by a congregation. And, you know, I think that there have been easier moments and more challenging moments. And
to have to write a thank you note for something so painful.
Yeah.
It's just something that most people don't have to experience
is really hard. And also, you know, I think people also, you know, I think though that there's a part of it, which is that, you know, in the happiest moments and in the saddest moments, even though I think people sometimes said things that were, you know, they came from love, but they maybe weren't exactly expressed right. You know, I think it's different than having an office job where you come back a week after you have a loss and people are like, sorry for your loss, now get back to work. I mean, people wanted me to get back to work, but for many months, I mean, probably for a year, people, I felt like, had an understanding or had a little bit of kindness that I don't think the average profession has. And yeah. So I think there's a little bit of like give and take. And, you know,
I always say that, and this is true, that, you know, you and Matthew and Lucy, you know, Cantor Lucy and Rabbi Leah and other clergy, it's really a calling. It's not a profession, it's a calling. And when I mess up at work, of course I feel badly. But when something happens here and you maybe disappoint someone, not with intention, you don't really feel it. I live it at home. I see it. I feel it. It's a very different profession. And there was a scene where Rebecca and Joanne run into each other, and Rebecca looks so sad, and she says, you have the life that I want. You have, you know, I wanted to be the rabbi's wife. I wanted to lead the community. And in that moment, I don't think Joanne really gets it, kind of like how I'm thinking that I didn't really get it. But you could see the pain on her face because she got it. She must have really grown up in a Jewish community that was that saw rabbi's wife, rabbi, maybe in a traditional way, maybe not, but saw it. And so...
Well, and I think that, you know, one thing that we did not see a lot of in the show, which I don't know what kind of role Rebecca will play in future seasons, but I think the idea that, you know, one of the things about having a job, a work, a calling, that's, it just, you know, the lines all become really blurry. So was she in love with Noah? Was she in love with
the role?
Was she in love with the attention she received from it? You know, I think that there are people who, you know, it's like from Fiddler on the Roof, right? Like, we only have one rabbi. He only has one son. And the idea of wanting, you know, she had this, like, we don't exactly know where all those things are. And maybe she, you know, maybe she loved the role and the idea of what she was going to have more than she loved him. Because obviously something wasn't, you know, we don't really get any of that backstory. But, you know, it seems like she would have been on one level, like the perfect Rebbetzin. You know, she's, you know, she looked the part and she was kind of, and she obviously fit into his family. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one piece that I thought was just like they had to kind of move her out quickly to start the Joanne storyline. But you have to wonder what exactly happened there to make it, you know, one thing that I don't think I got to say this. I'm just going to find, I just want to read this. Someone sent this to me, which is a rabbi who I don't know, named Will Hall, offered a beautiful sermon on the show on Yom Kippur about the many parts of our identities and how we need to allow those parts to intersect and find alignment, not simply come into conflict. So I love the idea of it being, you know, I have multiple identities and, you know, part of, I think, what makes anyone successful is how they blend them. So, you know, people know a lot about me and they know, you know, I love to read and I love theater and I love coffee and, you know, I don't really love sports, but guess what? You got a rabbi across the hall who loves sports. And we all sort of have the parts of us that I think we get to like let those parts flourish. And I don't know if my hobbies were like, were different. I mean, I don't know if I was like, I don't know if I like wanted to like have snakes or something. I don't know. Maybe people would think that was weird. But I think, you know, I think people ultimately, you know, I think there is an opportunity to have the multiple parts of your identity come out. And I think it gets complicated. You know, we are exactly a week out from the election. And I think that, you know, the election, Israel, anti-Semitism, political things, this, I think, is where the, like, multiple parts of our identities get really complicated.
It gets very complicated. And we saw that, you know, no one really talked about intersectionality until the Women's March.
Yeah.
Right? And I know we don't want to go into politics, but I do think you do touch on, you know, the public and the personal. And in our personal lives, we have a lot that defines us and what crosses over into the rabbinate and what is more, maybe more on the private side, I think is an interesting dynamic. And Noah, you can see Noah's in this place of tension where he has found love, but does that fit into his rabbinic life and the rules, the supposed rules?
Yeah, the rules.
Around that, rabbi and relationship, what does that mean? And a lot has changed since I married Matthew, for sure. But, you know, I remember, like, we chose not to live together until it was close to our wedding. We made that conscious decision. You know, I said when we were in person that Rabbi Levine of Road of Shalom, former Rabbi Emeritus, that he would say to Matthew, what you eat in private, that's up to you. But, you know, just be careful what you eat on the Upper West Side of Manhattan vis-a-vis treif, you know, lobster, bacon, egg, and cheese, if you choose to do that, because people might judge you. So how does your personal life fit into the rabbinate and vice versa is always a big topic.
And, you know, how do those things make you either bring people closer to you or make them feel farther away? Like, do you want your rabbi, and this is a question, you know, do you want your rabbi to be more like you, or do you want your rabbi to be someone who you are striving to be like?
Right.
And, you know, the rabbi of old, you know, old man who, you know, I don't
beard.
Know. Beard. You know, maybe your rabbi was into baseball. Maybe your rabbi was into, you know, music or something. But the idea of rabbis having kind of lives outside the congregation or outside of Torah, the idea that, like, you would expect your rabbi or cantor or, you know, to be learned in a certain way. And I think that today people want us to be learned, but I think they want us to be learned so we can, like, make it on one level. Like, I think if, you know, I think if I said, oh, I can't meet with you for 2 weeks because I'm studying Torah, people would be like, that's not the kind of rabbi I want. I want a rabbi who I can see, I can talk to about my life. I can, you know, talk about my kids. I can talk about the show. I can talk about anti-Semitism. But I think that what the rabbi means has also changed.
I think so too. And it depends on the denomination.
And the community.
And for sure the community. Yeah, absolutely. And I think when we're talking about roles, what do people want their rabbi to be? You just alluded to that. And are there expectations of spouses? And I have never felt any pressure here. I feel like when I haven't been around because I'm busy in my own professional life or with the kids, and I haven't run into someone in a while, it's when they say to me, I haven't seen you, it's not, I haven't seen you. It's really out of love. And I don't think any of our spouses feel ultimate pressure. I think it's really just how we choose or not choose to be involved. I have involved myself in ways where I feel like I can add value. But a rabbi and your role, I feel like, is more than just the role on paper. It's bigger than that for the family. I guess you can make a choice for it not to be. In my family, we have made it a choice, or I have made it a choice to be part of our family.
And I also think that, you know, talking about like multiple identities, you know, when you walk into the building, you are, you know, like, it's funny, I was thinking about how when you and I have been somewhere and I've introduced you to someone and, you know, my go-to is like, oh, this is Lauren Ruckin, she's Rabbi Matt's wife. But, you know, that might be how I met you, but it's almost like strange that that would be the way I would say it, even though it's the truth. But, you know, you are not just his wife, you are, again, all these things. And when you walk into this building, you know, there was a time when you were, you know, your kid's mom because they were in the preschool, or, you know, you were here for tutoring, or you're picking up one of your kids who's, you know, here on a Sunday, or you're and by the way, it spills into all these other things. You're dropping one of your kids off at my house to babysit, or, you know, you're dropping off a challah that your daughter made. And like, there are all these kinds of things where we're like all these different things all at the same time. But at the end of the day, it's sort of, I wonder if like the Rabbi Matt's wife kind of like rises to the top when you're in this building, because ultimately,
or in the community, because that's how people know me.
Right.
And I will be candid and honest and vulnerable that when we met and we were so young, or maybe not that young, but it was really hard because I was raised as a very independent person. You know, my dad always taught us to have our profession and, you know, to make sure that we're independent in addition to who we may choose. And it came from a loving place, but it was really hard when I met people initially, because Matthew had been at Road of Shalom for so long. He was so beloved and he was a hot rabbi, that people would say to me, "You're so lucky. You're so lucky. And are you Jewish because you met Matthew? You know, what's your religious observance now?" And it was hard. And it didn't come from any place that was not well-meaning. It was just they knew him, and that's how they could connect to me. But it was really hard, and it took a lot of work for me to be okay with that. That I'm my own person, and I had my own Jewish identity before I met Matthew, and it's really just how people know him and connect to him, and they want to get to know me, but I'm not working at the synagogue. They don't know me as well. So of course they love him. Like, he serves a role for, and so do you, for so many families in ways that I don't. And but it was hard in the beginning. It was really, really hard.
And I think, you know, I'm wondering if there's, I'm just thinking, you know, I think that probably exists for any clergy person. I wonder if it's more or less based on sort of the stage now. Like, I wonder if, you know, you could ask Liz about these things. Although I do think people sometimes will say, you know, she's lucky and you know, or, you know, but I feel lucky too, you know, and also that we didn't meet super young, you know. People, I mean, there are many people at the synagogue who've known me much longer than, you know, than my own wife. And so it's a different kind of thing. And I think there are a lot of people who felt maybe a little bit protective of me, of, you know, oh, who is this person? And what's, you know, what are your intentions with our rabbi? Yeah. But at the end of the day, you know, I think people, I think in the best scenario, people want their clergy to be happy, and they because they want to be happy and they want us to be, you know, because we are sort of integrated into their lives. And so, you know, when we do have to inevitably disappoint someone, you know, the idea of, you know, I can't be somewhere, or, you know, those sorts of things, that we're able to do so with a lot of relationship, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that the covenant part of it, like the idea of it's not just a job that you've signed a contract for, it's a life that you've chosen, and that life comes with, you know, real challenges sometimes, and it comes with incredible blessings.
And I think it goes both ways, because yes. while you may not be able to be at everything, there unfortunately are many, there's been times where you Matthew, get that horrible phone call, yep. and you have to leave a family vacation. And there's just an understanding that something happened that's beyond, and you have to respond. And that's why it's just bigger than a different job.
And I do think, you know, they had this one scene where he gets the call about that his, you know, ex-fiance was in the car accident. But I do hope that in season two, they have a real representation of, and it doesn't have to be the God forbid, but the moment where you just have to change your plans, right. and you have to be, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why Liz and I are a great fit, is because we both have careers that are unconventional, but also that are really, you know, that you sometimes can't plan, and you can make all these, you know, you can the best laid plans, but then something changes. And we have a really good understanding that, you know, sometimes, you know, we can, unless, you know, when you get on a plane, fine, that's like maybe, you know, and still there's God forbid.
Yeah.
But, you know, the idea that we, and that's one of the reasons why I think I try to really make my time with my family and my time at home separate as much as I can. It doesn't always work, right? I mean, we have phones, we have, you know, it could always be something, but when I'm at home, to try and be present with my family. And to be present with my, you know, the nights, there are lots of nights I don't put my daughter to bed, last night, tonight, you know, but the nights that I do, guess what? Like, I want to be there. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I've learned a lot from you watching you guys raise your kids and, you know, how it works and the choices you have to make. And, you know, in some ways I guess I felt like there was a little part of me that was like, the rabbi, like finding your partner as a rabbi is so hard, but like, then it's like, that seems so easy in comparison. Cause it's like, well, you know, you don't have, you know, like they're just dating. Like then you enter into, okay, what do you do now when, you know, people travel, people work, we all have responsibilities, we all have, you know, passions, and how do we like make it work with our families? Like, yeah. Your family becomes really important, and, you know, I think there's like a, if the show continues, whatever happens, we didn't really even touch on the interfaith part, but I really hope to see her identity, like her identity develop. Like, what does yeah. it mean for her to not just become like, you know, less about like who she's dating, but also like, what is it about her that, you know, like you can see she comes from this family that seems complicated. Like, what's the depth in her? Because I think rabbis mm-hmm. are drawn to deep, complicated people. Those are, no, I think it's true. You know,
I think you're right. Actually.
I am like really drawn. Those are the people I've always been drawn to. And part of it is we just have like deep, complicated lives.
Yeah.
I think
you're right. We should talk about the interfaith piece, because it's obviously a big piece of it.
And I should say, without revealing anything that anybody said in our in-person conversation, that I expected people to ask us questions, I guess, about us. And 100% of the comments and questions that people asked were about the interfaith piece and about the interfaith relationship, and lots of people whose children are in interfaith relationships, or they themselves are in interfaith relationships.
Right. I think you had a great statistic, and I can't remember what it was, how many of the movements or the rabbinic colleges are actually now open to the interfaith piece, where you can marry someone. I can't remember exactly what you said, but you could speak about that. But in my experience, and even some of the people who were there that day, those who have not converted, who are very much a part of this congregation, I believe are raising their kids the same way that any of us are, but they just haven't converted yet. And those who have converted, we should be saying thank you. Thank you for choosing Judaism. And a lot of times converts end up doing more in maybe the Jewish part of the marriage than the Jew by birth, which I think is an interesting dynamic.
You know, in my mom wasn't born Jewish and she did convert, but when I was in college, when she was an adult, but I would say, I think it was Eric Yaffe. Anyway, one of the presidents of the Reform movement, a long time ago, but sort of had this phrase about that non-Jewish partners raising Jewish kids were like the superheroes of Judaism, because they were the ones who were making hamantaschen and frying latkes and, you know, helping bar mitzvah tutoring. And my mom, who, you know, was not born Jewish and who, you know, but practiced Judaism and really, you know, allowed my brother and me to have a Jewish life. I mean, she was the one driving us to Hebrew school and signing us up. And, you know, because I'm me, I was in like the youth chorus and, you know, youth group events. But, you know, ultimately it was the like day-to-day part that, you know, allowed me to flourish. And I think that we should, I think sometimes there's a fear as if we like acknowledge that people either converted to Judaism or are not Jewish raising Jewish kids, that we will somehow insult them or make them feel othered. Where, you know, I think it's different for everyone, but sometimes I think that naming it, saying, you know, you have been an incredible part of not just taking your kids to soccer and field hockey and drama, but, you know, bringing them here and, you know, coming to Simchat Torah and taking your kid to Tachabat and, you know, making sure that you are, you know, your kid has everything they need for their bar bat mitzvah. That is a huge responsibility. And we really should be not just grateful, but we should really be, you know, the non-Jewish parents raising Jewish kids. You know, we call them like the phrase now people use is Jewish adjacent. Like, you are about as close as you can be because you're doing all this Jewish stuff, and synagogues have to wrestle with this. You know, yeah. There have been times about, you know, can you know, and even I think in the show, one of the things that I read was, you know, even if Joanne converted, was it going to be enough?
Like, would it be for the community or for him?
Or for the mother, right? All of
or
those
for
things.
The mother. Yeah. Because he's okay with it personally, although it's not like he didn't really dig in too deeply. It's a show. But he's more concerned about the community judgment and getting the job.
But you could see, I mean, I felt like, even though the scene with the Havdalah, which I thought was like, I thought it was a really sweet scene. I also like thought it was an interesting thing to choose, like the thing he was going to like choose
show her.
For her.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can tell that it matters to him. You know, like, I think one of the things that people sometimes forget is, I don't know, I can't speak for Matthew, but, you know, I love being Jewish. I have to imagine that if I wasn't a rabbi, I would have a full Jewish life. And it's actually really hard to love being Jewish and be a rabbi because I do it professionally. And when I, you know, it's Friday night at 8:00 and I get home from a full day where I've lit Shabbat candles 20 times for every preschool class and this and this and this and this, it can feel hard to like want to pull out my candlesticks and be like, okay, here we go again. But I know for me that if I don't do that, then I have like no Jewish life. I have no Jewish life that isn't
on your own.
On my own.
Yeah.
And I would say that no one's asking, but I'll tell you, you know, I have to work hard at that. And, you know, I'll be vulnerable. Liz grew up going to Orthodox Jewish day school, and she grew up doing Jewish things that I didn't. And one of the things she grew up doing, there's a tradition that when you get new clothes or new shoes, you're supposed to say the Shehecheyanu, and then there's a second blessing you say, which is thanking God for clothing people who need clothes. And you can't see me, but I'm wearing a new dress that I just got.
I didn't realize that.
This morning I was putting it on and I noticed, like, I took the tag off my dress in the morning and I, like, almost, not instinctively, I had to tell myself to do it, but I said the two blessings. And I thought, like, wow, this is not something I do in my, like, Rabbi Karen TBJ life, but it's a moment where I was like, thank you, God, for, like, I have enough money to buy a new dress. I have the, like, privilege to do that. I have clothes that fit me and whatever, like, all those things, and having, like, a moment of gratitude for myself.
I love that. That's beautiful.
I think those are the things. And there are things that, you know, I mean, I've been at your house many times for Shabbat, and I know that there are things you do that might be a little bit different than what happens maybe at Tachabat or something here, but, like, rabbis also deserve, clergy deserve to have
their own Jewish life that's separate.
A full Jewish life. And to, you know, and I think that one of the reasons why I know that Matthew was maybe a little resistant to watching it at first, and I was too, like, rolling my eyes, because I'm professionally Jewish.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, do I want to be
watching Netflix?
But I have to say that, you know, I got caught up, and, you know, it was hard. You know, after a few episodes, I was like, well, I want to know what happens. I want to know what's going to, you know. And I loved that they got to the bat mitzvah at the end, and, you know, what did it mean, and the way in which, you know, because he was obviously, I think it, that, like, they belonged to his synagogue. So there was, like, the personal, professional thing.
Right.
And I don't know. I feel excited. I felt excited to see a flawed Jewish character on TV who, you know, you really want to root for. And, you know, the millennial in me, you know, Adam Brody is, like, you know, heartthrob of the aughts. And I loved seeing Kristen Bell in, like, this role.
Yeah, I did too. It'll be interesting, because he kept saying he was trying to do the right thing. He was doing the right thing. You're converting for you, right? You're converting for you. But they hadn't developed what that even means, because he lit a few candles. It's a show. Of course it's a show. But they hadn't really developed her understanding of Judaism. And then I was happy that she said, well, wait a minute. No, like, I'm actually doing this for you. Right? And then you had what happened next. So,
well, and doing it, what I think that, like, even the doing it for you, doing it for him, like, I think if you polled people who converted, you know, there is something external in the world. Like, my mom converted for a bunch of reasons, but, you know, she always says one of the reasons was, you know, she was about to have a daughter who was becoming a rabbi. You know, I think part of it was, like, the external force in the world. There's always going to be something external that says, this is the right moment. But there has to be an internal piece too. It has to be sort of a both. It's like wanting to be a rabbi. You can want to be a rabbi very much, but you have to then go to rabbinical school. The calling, you know, it's not like the calling is enough.
Right.
It's the calling plus, you know,
all
the work. But I hope, you know, I hope that the show continues. And I think that we really, I hope are in for, you know, more. I hope we're in for more. I think that the, at least what I've read, now I follow Aaron Foster on Instagram.
Oh, I should do, like, that. I don't do that.
But I really am interested in how they're going to let the Jewish piece come through, and also how they're going to develop the other characters. Because I think that, you know, I don't know, they put a show into the world and you never know how it's going to be received.
Yeah.
But it has been, you know, I mean, I feel like we did a lot of work to prepare for Friday and for this. But there were just so many articles and people who loved
mainstream
it. Mainstream articles.
Yeah.
And there were also people, some of whom, you know, even reached out to us to say, you know, this is kind of like, this is
anti-Semitism.
This doesn't do a lot for the Jewish community,
yeah.
And it's also anti-Semitic. And I will say, at least for me, I don't think it's anti-Semitic. I think that stereotypes exist for a reason, and you see stereotypes in every TV show. And I think that the best kind of shows really try to transcend those stereotypes.
That might be a way to end, perhaps.
Well, this is either the first episode of our podcast or the only episode. But Lauren, this has been really fun.
So fun.
And we are...
Maybe stay tuned for season 2 in person.
in person season two. We'll tell you about it when we know about it.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Call Jeshurun. If you would like to learn more, visit our website at tbj.org and follow us on social media for updates on all our upcoming opportunities for engagement. We hope to see you soon.